The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we are going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin 60 miles from Boston, where the headline reads, "The Old Whaling Capital of New Bedford Looks Ahead." Written by Elizabeth Goodrich, the article appeared in the June 29, 2022 issue of the New York Times. Let's see what Elizabeth has to tell us. I have some folks here who are painting the other side of the house, my Airbnb host messaged me before a road trip to New Bedford, Massachusetts. The guys are really quite awesome, talented artists, lots of good vibes. Indeed, when Aaron, my travel partner, and I turned off County Street to find our home for two nights, a one-bedroom apartment in an 1855 Victorian that was once apparently rented by Herman Melville's sister, three painters were industriously updating the house's exterior with cream, orange, blue, and warm gray colors. These days, the entire city, approximately 60 miles from Boston, seems to be getting a fresh coat of paint. Signs of rejuvenation are everywhere, from a park honoring abolitionists to new murals on old buildings. Once the world's wealthiest city per capita and a powerhouse in whaling and textile manufacturing, New Bedford fell into decline in the mid and late 20th century, enduring a high crime rate, high unemployment, urban blight, and bad jokes. New Bedford, the armpit of Cape Cod, maybe the nation? An example of a joke. If they stopped at all, many travelers would stay only for a meal or a visit to the New Bedford Whaling Museum before continuing via ferry to Martha's Vineyard or driving Interstate I-95 to Cape Cod. Yes, New Bedford continues to lean heavily into its maritime past. Not only did we stay at the charming Whale House and visit the Whaling Museum, we also ate at the Whaler's Tavern and toured a restored mansion built on whaling money. But there's a focus on the present, too. Old textile mills are being reimagined, new restaurants are thriving, and exhibitions and parks are expanding to better tell the story's city's long history of promoting equality. Museums, downtown artist studios, and performance spaces speak to investment in the creative class. As for the future, the first train service from Boston since the late 1950s is expected to start next year. Its planned route is not without complaints. Thanks to healthcare and commercial fishing and other maritime industries, New Bedford remains a working city. It does not rely on tourism, though everywhere we went, we met proud, invested residents, from the volunteer docent at the Whaling Museum to the curator at New Bedford Free Public Library to the waitstaff at restaurants. There's no Cape Cod pretentiousness in the city, because we're really not Cape Cod. We're the South Coast, said Allie Copeland, the curator, adding that New Bedford has a very cool kind of vibe now. A creative economy. Our first evening, after stopping at the Quahog Republic Whalers Tavern for a golden ale and a Mai Tai, Aaron and I met Bev Enrich and Carl Friedman, eating outside on one of the city's cobblestone streets. The couple had recently moved from Providence, Rhode Island, to the nearby village of Little Compton. They had driven in for dinner with another couple at Union Flats, a seafood restaurant that opened this winter. The four friends raved about the monkfish and mackerel. Later we inhaled seared scallops, fresh and cooked perfectly, as well as the city's jazz and other cultural draws. The only reason we used to come here when we lived in Providence was to get the ferry, said Miss Enrich, 69, a retired university administrator. Now we're coming for fabulous restaurants, museums, and music. In 2017, Margot Saunier began her role as the creative strategist for the city of New Bedford, charged with implementing an arts and culture program. Since then, the city and partners have used grants and other funding to host free events, solicit and assist local artists to create public murals, and more. The more that we invest in our creative economy and our local talent in arts and culture, the better it is for everyone, Ms. Saunier says, and that includes people who live here and people who visit here. For the people who visit, New Bedford can be a relatively inexpensive. The art collection at the New Bedford Free Public Library displays work by contemporary artists like Adrian R. Teo, as well as old favorites Ralph Fasanella and Albert Bierenstadt, and John James Ottoman. At the Cape Verdean restaurant's Izzy's, a heaping can't-eat-fast-enough breakfast of cachupa, refogado, scrambled eggs, and linguica cost $13. CNBN3 Pass, $18 for adults, allows entry to the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center, New Bedford Art Museum, and the Roch Jones Duff House and Garden Museum, whose beds alone are worth the fee. A complex pass. The collapse of the whale population at the end of the 19th century came as enormous textile mills were being built, transforming the cityscape. But as manufacturing in the South and overseas gained prominence in the 20th century, these factories closed and New Bedford languished. The situation grew bleaker in the 1990s after local fisheries collapsed. For 50 or 60 years, there's been nothing going on because the textile plants closed up, said Mr. Friedman, 71, and a lawyer in Union Flats, speaking of New Bedford and other New England mill towns. Those energy-consuming industries will never fill these big buildings ever again, and that's why reimagining these buildings is the future. I spent the next morning walking around one reimagined mill in the city's South End neighborhood. Kilburn Mill, built in 1903 and expanded in 1910, is a three-building complex now home to shops, gyms, music performances, and the Bright Plant-Filled Dough Company restaurant, which sells a delicious green giant egg sandwich, $8, one with greens, pickled onions, and goat cheese. Breakfast fueled us as we toured downtown museums and strolled the streets. On one block alone, I discovered a toy store, a used record store, and a witch shop called Sanctum Folklorica. The highlight of the day was the Whaley Museum, adults $18, dedicated to the brutal industry that transformed New Bedford and the world. Through a rich collection, whale skeletons hanging from the ceilings, an explorable replica of a whaling ship, art collections, and more, we learn not only whaling history, but also the creature's biology and behavior, threats they face, and conservation efforts. The museum also looks at the people powering the industry, starting the local Native Americans, and then the mariners who came from around the world, including Cape Verde, the Azores, and the mainland Portugal, all settled here. Through culinary and other cultural differences, their presence remains strongly felt. One expanded exhibition at the museum and nearby park are dedicated to Captain Paul Cuff, a Quaker born locally to a Native American mother and African father in 1759. At a time when many Africans and African Americans were in servitude, Cuff ran blockades during the Revolutionary War and later became a wealthy shipowner and captain, using his influence to petition the state for the right for landowning men of color to vote and to establish one of the country's first integrated schools. Throughout the city, we learned about New Bedford's ties to Quakerism, which contributed to the city becoming a stronghold for abolitionism, a station on the Underground Railroad, and establishing a recruiting office for one of the first African-American regiments in the Civil War. This fall, the New Bedford Historical Society, along with the city, plans to unveil a park dedicated to the area's abolitionist movement. Abolition Row Park, built on an unoccupied corner lot, will include a statue of Frederick Douglass, a gazebo, and community garden space. What we have been intentional about in our funding is the certain stories that have not been told or have not been told to the masses, Ms. Saunier said. This is a renewed sense of celebrating that past. On the Harbor Walk. On our last evening, we biked south to the Harbor Walk, a walking and biking trail on the hurricane barrier that protects the New Bedford Harbor. The massive seawall, built in the 1960s, rises 20 feet above the Ashkenet River and offers views of lighthouses, ships, and passing ferries. Just beyond one set of its massive barrier gates lies Cisco Brewers, and kitchen and bar, a 3.5-acre restaurant and bar outdoor space that opened last June and welcomes dogs, children, and beer lovers with picnic tables, live music, and a dock for water-going guests. Aaron ordered food to share and two hazy IPAs, and we settled in to enjoy the scene. Farther south is the city's East Beach and Fort Tabor Park, a 50-acre green space and military museum, but those would have to wait for another visit. We finished our fried clams, listened to one last song, and in the cool ocean breeze, got back on our bikes. Nice story, huh? New Bedford. Sounds like fun. Well, from New Bedford, Massachusetts, let's fly across to Seattle, where it's almost normal, according to this story written by David Laskin. The article appeared in the September 1st, 2022 issue of the New York Times. And we'll read the subhead. The pandemic may have left some gaps in the urban fabric, but a neighborhood-by-neighborhood rundown of new restaurants and art events reveals that recovery is well underway. On February 9, 2020, the Seattle Asian Art Museum reopened after a three-year, $56 million renovation and expansion that transformed the look, feel, and reach of the venerable institution. 5 weeks later, the first round of statewide COVID lockdowns shuttered the place. It was heartbreaking for me and my colleagues, said Fun Ping, the Foster Foundation curator of Chinese art at the museum. It was shoulder to shoulder in the newly imagined galleries, then silence. This July, the museum, which reopened in May 2021, launched a new exhibition curated by Ms. Qin Fong called Beyond the Mountain, which showcases contemporary Chinese artists, including Zhang Huan, Yang Yangyalang, and Lam Tung Pang. It's a knockout show with bold, tech-enhanced multimedia works playing off traditional images and themes. And it's also a fitting symbol of a Seattle in the aftermath of the pandemic. Ink Media No. 4 by Chen Xiaozhang, with its full-wall projections of drawings based on photos of political protest, is one of the most exhilarating works currently on view in the city. But museum hours remain limited to 3 days a week, and the number of visitors has yet to reach pre-pandemic levels. In short, Seattle is back, but not all the way. The pandemic left gaps and tears in the urban fabric, or tears, I should say, in the urban fabric, probably tears too, huh? Especially downtown, and locals still mourn favorite restaurants that did not make it through. Boat Street Kitchen and Dahlia Lounge downtown, Il Corvo in Pioneer Square, the Paragon in Queen Anne Hill. But the city's defining cultural institutions remain healthy. New restaurants and coffee places are popping up all over town, and the communities ringing the center are more vibrant than ever. Capitol Hill makes a comeback. Capitol Hill, the neighborhood where the Asian Art Museum stands on the crest of the Olmsted Brothers-designed Volunteer Park, is a good example of the city's recovery. At the start of June 2020, less than a mile and a half south of the museum, the so-called CHOP, Capitol Hill-occupied protest, transformed the neighborhood's commercial art into a zone of fierce protest, ignited by the murder of George Floyd. Protesters filled a local park with tents and murals, did their own policing after the local precinct was abandoned, and distributed free food, though by the end of the month, a series of shootings in the area precipitated the clearing of the CHOP protesters. At first, it was beautiful, says Pietro Borghese of the action swirling around the Capitol Hill restaurant, Osteria La Spiga, which he said he and his wife, Sabrina Tinsley, owned. Then it became like the Wild West, he said. But the CHOP had barely unraveled when new bars and restaurants began appearing on the site. The airy plant-filled wine bar Light Sleeper opened in 2020 in the courtyard of the stylish Chop House Row Urban Mini Mall. Around the corner on East Union Street, Overcash Office, touting bikes, beers, and coffee, sprouted under the same roof as the Media Seattle Bike Shop, which also offers rentals. Other bright new additions to Capitol Hill include Nasir Zabir's Karachi Cowboys on 12th Avenue, with dishes fusing Pakistani street cuisine, Texas barbecue, and soul food. Try the keema, a simmered ground beef and veggie dish, starting at $17, and Marapili, Tapas Bar, a few blocks south on the site of the former Cafe Press, and featuring classics like Patatas Bravas, $10, Gazpacho, $5, and Pollo Afiero, poached octopus with crispy potatoes, for $20. Now on to the Ballard and the Central District, still on the rise. Another classic Seattle neighborhood, Ballard, north of downtown, where generations of Scandinavian fishermen resided, was flourishing pre-pandemic. The 2018 opening of the dazzling new home of the National Nordic Museum, designed by the Seattle-based Methuen architecture firm, added new luster and parking. Local culinary standbys like San Fermo, Sawyer, and Indian Bistro came through the pandemic in good shape, with outdoor seating options continuing, but there are some outstanding new additions. Ballard's branch of Spice Walla, a 10-minute walk from the museum, is a typical pandemic startup. Small, fast, nimble, focused on just a few zesty dishes to eat in or take out. A Lu Tiki fried potato roll is $7.50, the spicy chicken tiki roll $7.50, and then there's masala aloo fries with a twist for $3.50. Need a shot? Rafael Apapa Chango Cafe, a new Miami-themed coffee place serving Panther coffee, that's cafe con leche, is $4.75. The chocolate caliente, $3.50, and less than 10 minutes by foot from the museum. Now, the Central District, Seattle's historically black neighborhood east of downtown, was gentrifying fast even before the pandemic, and if anything, the contested opening of the neighborhood's Amazon Fresh supermarket in 2021 has intensified that trend. Communion, Christy Brown's sumptuous soul food restaurant that started serving at the height of the pandemic, has turned the district into a dining destination. New twist on old favorites like watermelon salad with shaved onions and feta, $14, grilled okra for $14, jambalaya, $32, and they've sent critics swooning and diners flocking. If you can't score a dinner reservation, try lining up for Sunday brunch. You have cornbread French toast for $24, hush puppy and grits, $18, and while you're waiting, grab a Jabena brewed Ethiopian coffee for $4.50. At the four-month-old Aviol coffee next door, or a raspberry ginger donut at Ray's Donuts and Cakes across the street. Farther south, in the emerging Hillman City neighborhood, Archipelago has become scoring high marks for its harmonious meldings of Northwest ingredients and Filipino cuisine. Downtown's meaningful recovery is our next segment. There is no question that the pandemic hit Seattle's downtown hard, and the area continues to struggle with homelessness, crime, and vacant buildings. Usage of downtown office space is still only 43% of what it was in 2019. It didn't help that tourism fell off a cliff, with a total visitation, day trips, and overnight stays plunging to 22 million in 2020 from 41.9 million in 2019, before edging back up to 26.6 million last year. But John Boshi, the senior vice president of tourism at Visit Seattle, reports that the city finally saw meaningful recovery this spring and summer, fueled by pent-up demand. Cruise ships are back with a vengeance. The Mariners, enjoying their best season in years, are drawing crowds to T-Mobile Park south of downtown. And Pike Place Market is once again packed with pedestrians and sporting new restaurants, including May's Tortilleria for authentic Mexican street food and Sugohanyo Hand Roll for exquisite Japanese seafood and veggie wraps. Now, even Pioneer Square, the city's original downtown with red brick Romanesque revival buildings and pedestrian malls, which emptied precipitously during the pandemic, is getting a welcome new jolt of energy because of the ongoing waterfront development following the removal of the elevated highway known as the Alaskan Viaduct. The new Seattle Aquarium Ocean Pavilion, slated to open in 2024, will be the marquee structure on the reconfigured waterfront. Construction is also well along on a series of ramps, viewpoints, and promenades linking both Pike Place and Pioneer Square with the shore of Puget Sound. By the way, having been there myself, you can't miss Pike Place if you go to Seattle. That's another story for another day. Anyway, Fen Hu Wang, the director of Pioneer Square's esteemed Foster White Gallery, notes that during the pandemic, local galleries collaborated on remote art exhibitions like the Seattle Deconstructed Art Fair, in which 50-odd local galleries showcased the work of their leading artists online, and now in-person visits are ticking up. First Thursday art walks have once again begun to attract healthy crowds, and Foster White is eagerly anticipating the September 1st opening of a new show by the emerging ceramic sculptor Calvin Ma. Pioneer Square favorites like Cafe Paloma and the London Plain have happily survived, and 5 months ago a promising Peruvian newcomer called Señor Cabon Peruvian Cuisine joined the depleted roster of local eateries. Lomo Saltado, that's flap steak and fries, is $24, and Pulpo a la Parrilla, grilled marinated octopus, $26, and they're among the popular plates. In May, the hipster-friendly Netherlands-based Citizen M hotel chain opened a second Seattle location in Pioneer Square to take advantage of the newly sweeping waterfront views. Rooms begin at $172. Perhaps the neighborhood's quirkiest new addition is the penthouse apiary, established in June at the pinnacle of Smith Tower, Seattle's first skyscraper. The honey is already being stirred and shaken into cocktails at the tower's 35th floor bar and observatory. Amazon, which has transformed the downtown South Lake Union neighborhood from a backwater of grubby light industry to a hive of tech employment and recreation, worked to keep area commerce alive during the pandemic, and the effort paid off. Now, right at the edge of the Amazon campus, there's the spiffy new tech-forward Astra Hotel Seattle, a tribute portfolio hotel with a whimsical outer space vibe, rooms starting at $279. Its sleek roof terrace bar slated to blast off the first week of September. Just a couple of blocks to the south, the level South Lake Union is another newcomer to the neighborhood with clean, spare suites offering full kitchens and balconies. A climbing wall and indoor basketball court top the list of sporty amenities. The level suite, the smallest unit, sleeps four with rates starting at $299. COVID may have slowed Seattle's explosive growth and eased its congestion, but now traffic is back, and so is the dynamism that has come to characterize this youthful, diverse, innovative, and increasingly decentralized urban hub. Wow, quite a story there. Well, let's round out today's travel in Alaska, slowing down to take things in. That's the name of the article written by Jenna Schnauer, and it appeared in the January 24, 2022 issue of the New York Times. And the way it's subheadlined, there are fewer miners now, but nature enthusiasts visit the town of McCarthy, and this is in the area we'll be exploring, to learn field sketching, a technique that's equal parts art and science. With rain hitting the roof, the temperature outside hovering in the low 50s, and a cast iron stove keeping things warm inside the cabin that on this July weekend is serving as an art studio and classroom, I feel a nap coming on. Summer days in Alaska, they're not always the bluebird skies promised in travel ads. But there's no time for napping on this trip to McCarthy, a bustling summer community of artists, writers, seasonal workers, and visitors that sits 60 miles down a gravel road in Wrangell St. Elias National Park and Preserve. I'm here to expand the techniques I use to observe and record the natural world to gain a deeper understanding of the animals, plants, and geology of the state I've called home for 8 years. Over the next 2 days, I'll attend a field sketching workshop taught by the science illustrator and natural history artist Kristen Link through the Wrangell Mountain Center. A practice that's equal parts art and science, field sketching is used by researchers and artists to record their observations of nature, from waterways to winged creatures, mosses to mountaintops. Field sketching pairs illustrations with notes about weather, location, animal behavior, and even the journal keeper's mood that day, offering more context than a standalone photo. It's also a powerful tool for travel, one that forces you to slow down, take things in, to simply look. I'm excited about the class, but there's just one problem. I can't draw. Miss Link, who lives in McCarthy year-round, discovered field sketching in art school. It's like you're more present, and because you're kind of quiet, you can hear people's conversations and engage with place in a different way, she said. The town of McCarthy got its start as a turnaround station for the railroad and became the bawdy neighbor with liquor, gambling, and prostitution to the more serious mine and mill town of Kennecott, 5 miles up the road, where copper was discovered in 1900. The town of McCarthy got its stop as a turnaround station for the railroad and became the bawdy neighbor. And then its population has been slowly growing over the last decade. In 2010, the town had just 28 residents. In 2020, the number rose to 107, now about 300 in the summer, still a far cry from the 1,000 or so people who lived between McCarthy and Kennecott in the early 1900s, when the mill and mines were running at full tilt. Now McCarthy is forever in a state of being built up and falling apart. Stacks of fresh lumber sit steps away from wooden buildings, being overtaken by nature, sedges and wildflowers poking out between splintered planks. There's a new side staircase being added to the general store where you can buy scoops of made-in-Alaska ice cream or some duct tape to fix many of the challenges Alaska throws at travelers. The town is also an unofficial museum of dead trucks. Some have moss growing on their fenders. But it's at McCarthy's, dogs off-leash and on their own agenda, that shape the town's character. From short-legged mutts to sizable malamutes, all play roles in town, from unofficial mayor to greeters and village clowns. Hercules, a 12-week-old puppy, spent most of his time snoozing on the porch of Ma Johnson's hotel, my accommodations for the weekend. The pale yellow two-story building is one of the many in town that date back to the mining and mill days. The former general store, which now houses the Wrangell Mountain Center, is also a McCarthy original. Though the wooden building sat quiet for 60 years after the mining company pulled out of Kennecott and people deserted both towns, several have been restored and repurposed for modern-day visitors without too much updating. After Wrangell St. Elias National Park and Preserve was established in 1980, the area began to draw tourists. Long before this, the land was home to the Athanabascan people, who still practice traditional subsistence hunting and fishing in the area. The Athna Alaska Native Corporation currently owns 622,000 acres within the park and preserve. If the computer behind the check-in desk and the guest iPhones charging in the lobby disappeared, Ma Johnson's would likely resemble the boarding house it was 80 years ago. The walls and floor are layered with art, velvet chairs, and thick carpets. My room is one flight up. There isn't much room to walk around the bed, but I'm already tired after a 7-hour drive from my home in Anchorage. After some wine and dinner across the street at the hotel's fine dining restaurant, the Salmon and Bear, the plush bed will be my only concern. At the restaurant, foraged mushrooms, sautéed and served atop a searing hot stone, surprised me by stealing my attention from the buttery flesh of a dish of black cod. It's easily my favorite meal in recent memory. The next morning, the 13 members of the field sketching class gathered at the old general store, and this is for breakfast and then a meal of warm oatmeal that will help stave off the chill in the air. Some easy chatter starts up. A woman who lives up a nearby mountain details her muddy drive down to McCarthy on a four-wheeler. Others, Miss Link included, talk about the Facebook Nature Journaling group they joined during the lockout. And there's talk that we're each staying, where we're each staying. Some at Ma Johnson's, others in camping tents, and others just tired of the nonstop rain. In their cars in a nearby campground. One woman and a seasonal guide living in Kennecott, and a Seattle woman staying nearby in a friend's yurt. And a 2.5 pandemic years without meeting new people, it feels good to expand the circle of creative people in my world. And that's where we'll end today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you've had some fun visiting these locales and that you'll join us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, and that's ncreadingservice.org. Again, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.